Welcome to Microbrew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, and on the other line is Kurt Hoge, beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The Milwaukee Brewers, they only went 3-3 this week. They swept the Tampa Bay Rays. They dropped 2-3 in St. Louis, and I don't even know how to characterize this one, because I think there are two things that are true here. There is a win on Saturday night against St. Louis that I think might be arguably the most important win of the season thus far. I think it was a little bit stolen, and it might have kind of saved their season. And on the other hand, they do fall behind the eight ball. The offense cannot muster up much in St. Louis, and dropping 2-3 puts them behind in the season series, which is key, puts them still a game and a half out of first place, which is key. So honestly, I don't feel great about a week in which two of their three wins were sort of dramatic, probably could have gone the other way very easily. They could easily be 1-5. So I'm torn. So Kurt, we're going to start just in a big picture. This offense, it's gone up and down. I think we've discussed the last couple of weeks that maybe it's a little better than we thought it was. Against teams like the Cardinals, though, it still really, really fights and claws and scratches to get anything it can get. You know, they also barely won a game against Tampa Bay thanks to some ninth inning and 10th inning heroics. And then they go into this series, and they just frankly, they didn't score enough runs. They lose 3-1 in the opener. They went 3-2 in extras, thanks in part because of the Manfred man in extras. And then on Sunday, they score three runs, one home run in the ninth inning after the Cardinals had taken the lead. I'm not feeling great about this offense. I still feel like this team is not better than the Cardinals. It's not better than any of the other playoff contenders. Not good enough anyway to get back into that playoff chase. Maybe I'm being a little pessimistic, but just give me your progress report after you've seen this week, what you're thinking about this offense, and maybe what they could possibly do to jumpstart things a little bit.
It's not so much this week that has changed any opinions. This feels like a lot like the 2020 season to me. This team is better than that team. I think the roster by leaps and bounds is better, and the record shows that they're better as well. But since June 1st or May 31st or whatnot, they've been a below 500 team, just by a little bit, I think. And this weekend they had two chances to get back in first place, and they lost both games. And it felt similar to that season when, how many times, JR, did they, get to 500 or get within one game of 500? Or it was one or the other. I can't remember if they couldn't get to 500 or if they couldn't get over. But either way, there was a hump there, and they just never, ever, ever could get over it despite 7 or 8 or 9 tries. And granted, they've only been in second place now for, a week and a half. So there will be more cracks at it. The schedule gets tougher. But just another week of sort of okay baseball, and luckily enough they're still hanging around, but they'll need to play much better than they have.
Yeah, very fortunate, I think, to have come out with a 500 record this week and to still be in shouting distance of a playoff spot. I believe the Phillies now have fallen below San Diego. The Padres had a great finish to the week, so I believe it's a game and a half behind Philadelphia are the Brewers, and a game and a half behind the Cardinals in the NL Central. There are 7 good teams in the NL. Everybody else is below 500. The Brewers right now are the 7th of those teams. They look like an odd team out. They look like the team that's going to miss the playoffs of those 7. And I think I've said this before, you can have one good run during the course of a season and then just kind of tread water the rest of the season and still be a playoff team under the current model. Their run came in April and May. They were really good. They were 13 above 500, even as of, I think, June 2nd. And then that's when the 8-game losing streak falls in, and they really haven't gotten themselves out from under that. Under that hole they dug for themselves, they're now 9 games above 500. And like you said, they've been a middling to below average team since the beginning of June. And, I go back to that question, what can they do to jumpstart it? I don't know what the answer is. I think it does fall on the offense. The bullpen's okay. The additions they made, some guys like Matt Bush had a great week. Taylor Rogers, we'll talk about him, had a rough Sunday, and we haven't seen a lot of him. So I don't know if I could say that the bullpen is markedly better. I think the starting pitching is about what you'd expect, to a little below average from what you might have hoped for coming into the year. And I'm just looking for ways that what they could do, play Keston Hiro more or bring up Sal Frelick. I'm trying to come up with any solution that they have. 7 and a half weeks of the season still to play. There's still plenty of time, but is that solution there? At this point, Kurt, I'm wondering, I know they're not out by much, so they could easily still do this, but it kind of just feels like they just have to hope. They just have to kind of hope they go on a 6-7 game run. I don't know. Is there something I'm missing? Something that maybe this team can legitimately do to turn things around, I guess?
Have they considered putting hats on their bats.
Ooh, hats on bats. Rally hats. Hats
for bats.
Rally hat bats. Bats.
Or some sort of prayer circle
with
the bats.
That's hope, Kurt. That's just hope. We categorize prayer circles under hope.
Hey, Bob Uecker would have some ideas from Pedro Serrano. So ring that man up. I mean, the word that has kind of been floated around, you know, kind of when talking to the front office about this team throughout the year is internal improvements. They're looking for internal improvements. And, you know, if they're going to get better, it has to come from within the room for the most part. And you kind of figured they would add some more guys, but they really did it. So it's literally all internal improvements. And, you know, there's only, 6 weeks left? So a couple hot streaks could do it. But then there's also the question, JR, of like, you look around the lineup and you kind of compare what the guys are doing to their career numbers. And who exactly in their in the lineup has, like, you feel like, you know, has that level to reach, you know, that he's shown in his career that he's not showing right now. Now, sure, guys can just get hot, but I just don't know what I would bank on from that, if you know what I mean by that.
Yeah, I do. I mean, the only answer to me is Christian Yelich, and I think at this point we know that's. This is who he is. He's had a rough August on top of it, but you know, he's not that guy anymore. And you're right. Everybody else is kind of achieving what you'd sort of expect them to achieve, I guess.
Maybe Andrew McCutchen could get going, but like over the last 3 years, this is kind of what he's been.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I wonder. I personally think we might see Sal Frelick. You know, the minor league season isn't going to be going for a whole lot longer. He's hitting the ball very well at AAA. I don't know if he's ready. I don't think he is. But there's an opening here. Like Jonathan Davis is like he's a fine backup center fielder, but he's not giving you anything offensively. He's got, I think, 16 hits and 15 of them are singles. Like, this is a guy that you have because you have no one else to play center field in case Tyrone Taylor's unavailable or you need a day off. So maybe there's an option there, although I don't know. I don't think Frelick can. I don't know about the center field thing, but there seems to be an opening on this roster for someone.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, I don't think Jonathan Davis is particularly better than Sal Frelick at this point, especially considering, like, Jonathan Davis just didn't play for what, 10 days. They just played Tyrone Taylor every day. Mm-hmm. And so he's on the roster, but he wasn't used at all. I don't think calling up Frelick's necessarily like the answer, capital T and capital A, Allen Iverson, but it's a possibility to sort of like pull a, you know, a late 2019 Trent Grisham and see if he can buoy your offense somewhat. I mean, the OBP for Tyrone Taylor is just not there. The defense has been good to find a good, with some flashy moments, but, yeah, I mean, it's going to have to be internal improvements. And also, I mean, just like it's going to like 5-6 weeks of bunching your runs better, you know, not, you know, when you score 6 runs, not giving up 8 runs that day, you know, and not being the one day out of every 2 weeks where your pitching staff gets shelled. It seems like that's kind of been the case recently. And like this St. Louis series was probably, outside of that Taylor Rogers implosion, probably their best pitching series in a while. They yeah. pitched really well. And they just decided the offense, you know, it was their time to disappear. So, yeah, luck, hope. And in baseball, those aren't necessarily terrible strategies, though.
No, well, when you're close, that's kind of how this happens. When you're close to a playoff spot, sometimes that's enough when you get a small enough sample. 7 weeks to go, like I said, 7.5. Schedule mostly okay, not in the near term. The Los Angeles Dodgers coming to Milwaukee for 4 games. The Brewers will be back home a lot. We've talked about that before, but they're not also playing that great at home. So they were able to get this 2-game sweep against Tampa, but losing the previous series against the Reds, like they're not playing their best at home or anywhere. So we'll see if it matters. I really think they got to split this series. The Dodgers coming off a 12-game winning streak. They had that snapped on Sunday against Kansas City, but they are white hot. They're 45 games above 500 or something incomprehensible, and they're far and away the best team in the National League. So we'll see if they are able to at least split that. That would be a nice thing for them.
It is quite foolish how good the Los Angeles Dodgers are every single season.
It's ridiculous.
It's absurd.
I mean, it's really maddening that they're going to be the playoffs and they'll probably lose because baseball, and this team with all these absurd wins will just disappear like the LDS or something. I mean, that's It's a very unfair when you're that much better than everybody else. You just deserve to go to the World Series, and that's obviously not going to happen for them. So good for teams like the Brewers who are still in the mix, because that is the way it's set up. Let's spend a little bit of time going back to the Josh Hader trade, revisiting the topic that will not die. I think maybe a little bit this week it sort of cooled because a couple things happened. First of all, early in the week, Josh Hader had a terrible performance for the San Diego Padres. He blew a save, had a 3-run lead, a lot of hits, or I should say a lot of walks, hit batter in there, did not have any command or control. Some of the issues that the Brewers saw with him before the trade deadline. The Padres do go on to win that game, but some nervousness from Padres fans, and maybe a little bit of a sigh of relief for Brewers fans who felt like still giving up Josh Hader is a very damaging thing. Now Taylor Rogers in the bullpen, they had certainly some ups this week. And then on Sunday, Taylor Rogers gives up 4 runs in the 8th inning, and that cost the Brewers a chance to win the series against St. Louis. Although, again, the offense wasn't doing much. It was a 2-2 tie for a good chunk of that game. So that happened. Denilson Lamet is pitching really well for Colorado. You know, these are the highest leverage situations in the world. One of them was a tie game against Arizona, for what that's worth. But Lamet, 5 scoreless innings thus far. We're talking the smallest sample on earth, but when you've got a guy that you let go for nothing, essentially, and you see him perform well elsewhere with Colorado of all places, it certainly is something that'll make you scratch your chin a little bit. And, you know, I'm still thinking about Jake McGee a little bit, the veteran who was on the staff, who was ultimately cut later in the week when Lamet was the guy who was chosen to go first ahead of Jake McGee. And it feels like there was a little more potential and ceiling with Lamet than there was with McGee. And I'm kind of surprised the Brewers made that call and then ultimately cut ties with both of them. Maybe that doesn't matter. Maybe it ends up being just a few days and they end up cutting Lamet in McGee's space and vice versa. And it doesn't really matter. But I didn't get a chance to talk to you last week. I had Todd, so I didn't know if you had any lingering thoughts about it. Now that we know the full picture of how the trade deadline shook out, certainly that cosmic week with the Pirates and Reds was caused some heartburn for Brewers fans. And now a week later, how are you feeling? What are sort of the vibes around this trade for you?
This is the trade that it just will not. I mean, we know it's not going to go away, but it will not get out of the storylines and the headlines because it's always relevant. Something, it's just weird things keep happening. Josh Hader gets traded and he blows up in, you know, his first really big outing with the Padres. Taylor Rogers comes over and is hurt, and it's been something he's been dealing with, and then, you know, he's had a couple of bad games. And then the guy that they cut, like you said, Lamet goes out and he's pitching well. So it's funny because, like, the thing that I think everyone would still say is that this trade will not, you know, this trade will be defined by how Gasser and Esteury Ruiz turn out. But there's still a lot of things shaking out with it right now. So it's strange. I do have some thoughts. I just don't know where to really begin with them because it's just a weird situation.
You know, you brought up the injury. That's kind of to Taylor Rogers. That's kind of the new a new wrinkle. The Brewers knew that he came over with some knee soreness and he was unavailable. We've barely seen him. You know, he's only pitched 4 times since that trade deadline in 2 weeks. And granted, Josh Hader's in the same boat. I think he's only made 4 appearances. If maybe only 3 for San Diego. So neither guy has worked a ton, but if you believe that this was not a 1-for-1 swap in terms of major league, it's way more complicated than that. But, you know, the Brewers had a pretty good feeling about Taylor Rogers. They thought he could do the most of what Josh Hader would have been expected to do. And we've seen him just very sparingly. The injury is now a factor too. It's like, so they traded for 3 guys when you subtract Lamet, one of whom was the major leaguer who had some injury question marks. And not only that, but had gone through a really rough July, much like Josh Hader. It feels like the return just is diminishing in front of our eyes, you know, over the course of 2 weeks. And I don't want to be unkind to Taylor Rogers because he's still got a great track record. He's still a very good pitcher. He has struggled a little bit in a couple of the outings that we've seen him. So that sort of adds a little gasoline to the fire. But, you know, like it seems like every day or every 2 days, there's a new revelation or a new wrinkle that's like, man, I don't know how I feel about it overall. I still think there's a really good chance this trade works out for the Brewers, unquestionably. I just, the more this goes on, it's like, I can't believe they made this deal. Like, I really can't believe they made it and made it with a fair amount of confidence too, Kurt. So, you know, that's kind of where I'm at, I suppose.
Yeah, I can totally believe that they made the deal. And like, in a sense, it makes a ton of sense to get something for Josh Hader now, before you inevitably are, you know, you're going to lose him for nothing. But what doesn't, yeah, there's just the, like you said, some head scratching things. I don't necessarily understand DFAing Lamet when McGee was, you know, his standing was so rocky that you can DFA him after two outings. Like, they DFA'd Lamet Wednesday, and then McGee pitched that same night. And then I think he pitched last Saturday and gave up a few runs. And all of a sudden he was the next guy. And I was like, really? That's you were not that committed to him. And yeah. So, I mean, clearly Lamet was a throw in to the trade, and the Brewers didn't particularly ever like have much. I don't know. I just don't think they were very high on him, but still just a kind of a strange thing. And I think they probably would have been better off finding a way to keep him on the roster, but that's neither here nor there. Actually, that is here and there, but not here nor there to the point that I'm trying to get to, on this winding road, is that if you, we've talked about this, not on the pod, but we've talked about this, is that why would the Brewers make this trade now when they could have gotten this return in the offseason? Certainly could have done that if they didn't have concerns about Hader's performance. You know, they figure that not only can they figure basically they could match what he would do the rest of the year with Taylor Rogers. We'll see if that ends up being the case. But there were some concerning signs. I think Baseball Prospectus had a good story about his, you know, his arm slot and release points and all those things. And he doesn't look like Josh Hader right now at all, and guys are hitting the ball and he's missing his spots all over. So I think internally, you know, if you kind of read between the lines a little bit, there were some concerns like that. Oh, now is the time to, you know, maximize our return for him, because who knows if we're going to be able to get this much, you know, relatively speaking, in the offseason. So that's kind of a little bit of a, you know, reading on some things that were implied and whatnot, but that's kind of my take on it now.
All right, let me take this in a little bit of a different direction, but related to Taylor Rogers, something happened on Sunday that caught my eye a little bit and made me wonder about something. Rogers, in the eighth, he'd given up the go-ahead home run. The Cardinals had taken a 3-2 lead, and then two outs, Albert Pujols strolls to the plate. Pujols, who continues to be just a terror, he already had one home run in the game. He comes up and he hits a three-run homer to essentially put the game out of reach. Now, Rogers a lefty. Pujols doesn't hit righties well at all. He's primarily a guy who just mashes lefties, and Rogers was left in there to face him. And that, you know, looking back, kind of surprising. Now, on the one hand, Taylor Rogers was a closer most of the year and considered a good enough pitcher that you don't mix and match with matchups with him. You let him work a full inning. He's that level of player. So there is also that. But, you know, it got me thinking about Craig Counsell a little bit as a manager, his style. It's changed, I think, a little bit over the years, since 2018, when he was kind of given a lot of credit as a guy who mixed and matched his bullpen arms. He was not afraid to let guys go multiple innings. He was not afraid to put guys in non-traditional spots. You know, the roles weren't so carved out. You know, there was a big thing about the out-getters. There was no necessarily like shape to it where the starter goes five and then maybe you got a bridge guy and then you've got your seventh, your eighth, your ninth inning guy. That wasn't how Craig Counsell operated. Over the last couple of years, it has been how he's operated. And for most of this year, I would say it was Boxberger in the seventh, Williams in the eighth, Hader in the ninth. No wavering from that, if the team had the lead, a close lead in particular. Now, with Josh Hader gone, I thought, well, maybe we'll see more of the mixing and matching, because so much of, I think, our understanding of that situation was that Josh Hader really preferred to be in a very specific role, that being the ninth inning, the closer spot, you know, the tied or close lead situations, and one inning only. We haven't seen that. We've seen guys, and Matt Busch has moved around a little bit because of circumstances, but we've primarily seen Craig Counsell stick to this sort of, formulaic is probably too strong, but just a predictable approach. And that surprises me a little bit, because the other one was very successful. And so I don't know if you feel that there's reasoning behind that. In no way do I want to suggest that I don't think Craig Counsell is doing a great job. I think I think he's absolutely a tremendous manager. The proof is in the pudding. He's going to be here for a long time, pretty much as long as he wants. So I'm just surprised to see that change, because it feels like that was one thing that separated him from his peers and made him as effective as possible. But over the last couple of years, it's kind of fallen into this sort of, I would say, familiar, somewhat predictable design. What are your thoughts on that? Am I seeing things, or do you feel like that's kind of a true thing?
No, I think you're saying something. I think you're definitely saying something, and a lot of Brewers fans are seeing it too. And a lot of it was Josh Hader, you know, wanting to only pitch one inning and pitch the ninth inning. It did sort of tie, you know, it sort of ties the rest of the bullpen's hands A little bit. But, you know, Devin Williams has been a one inning guy, consistent, you know, same inning every time sort of thing. Like, even if their team was in trouble in the seventh, you know, are they really going to go to Devin Williams then? Even when, you know, when Josh Hader's around? Not really. And so we kind of figured there'd be more mixing and matching after the trades for Bush and for Rodgers and Hader being gone and a little more flexibility. And I think the Brewers, you know, Counsell himself even said more mixing and matching. And I just feel like we haven't really seen that since the trade. You know, Bush has kind of been the seventh inning guy if there's a lead, although it's, you know, due to unavailability, it kind of hasn't played out this way all the time. And then Rodgers and then Williams. And that's been the formula. And they just haven't, you know, I expected maybe a little more wavering from that. And there just hasn't been a ton of it. In terms of Sunday's game, like, I totally get, you know, why is Taylor Rodgers facing Pujols when he's the lefty there? I think the other side of the equation, though, is like, who do you go to? The Cardinals are going to, you know, pinch hit and they'll still have the platoon advantage. So is it, you know, you could go to Matt Bush there realistically, but the Brewers probably aren't going to go to him when they're down by a run already. It's just not what they do. So it would have been Brad Boxberger, right? Unless I'm just whiffing on another right-handed arm because Trevor Gott's hurt. And I don't think there's a lot of trust in big, big, bad Brad Boxberger right now. So it was a sort of a pick your poison. And the poison that was picked was cyanide.
yes. They definitely, it definitely did not work out. Brad Boxberger indeed has had some adventures. Great week for Matt Bush. Two saves, both born of strange circumstances, but able to get one against the Rays on Tuesday, and then again on Saturday in that very improbable win in St. Louis, where the Brewers kind of stole one in extra innings. Matt Bush had a big 10th inning to lock that one down. So at least a little bit of a relief that that he is able to he has bounced back from his first two rough outings as a Milwaukee Brewer. Let's talk briefly. We're gonna get to three up, three down here in a moment. Let's talk briefly about two guys that we've talked a lot about. That's Christian Yelich and Keston Hira. And I'm gonna start with Yelich. It's been a really rough month. I believe I said 536 was the OPS in August, 537. Coming into today, he's 0 for his last 22. His leadoff numbers are still overall good. I mean, that's definitely where he belongs. We had this toe tap change that for a while it looked like his timing had returned. He'd really sort of turned a corner, I thought. And unfortunately now it's sort of back to where we were. He has not hit a home run since July 2nd. So we're well over a month, a month and a half at this point, where he hasn't hit home runs yet. And Kurt, that part still just throws me, because if we believe that the knee injury is really the turning point in this whole thing, and it still very well may be, well, 2020, he still hit 12 home runs in 60 games, which isn't the same pace he was at in 18 and 19, but like, it's not nothing. He has not hit 12 home runs in a full season. Certainly not, not yet this season when he's on 80. He only had 9 last year. The power is just not there at all. And that mitigates what he can do. Ultimately, it's why his OPS ends up being so low. He's a guy who's, you know, he's not a slap hitter. Like, he still can hit doubles and stuff, but he could be doing really well, but if there's no power, the second he goes into just a little bit of a slump, it starts showing much louder than I think it would be otherwise. Where are you at with Christian Yelich? Just checking in on him and what you think of him so far, and or not so far, but to this point in the season, and maybe I don't know if you've got any explanation as to where things have gone here in August.
Here's my take on it, and my take is that there's really no new take, and I'll explain why this is a take here. Well, that's a lot of the word take, I think that, like, when it comes down to it, there have been these sort of stretches throughout the year, this year, even last year, where, for whatever reason, Christian Yelich looks, I don't want to say he's not back, but he looks, you know, more like his old self, where the timing is good, he's driving the ball, whether or not it's home runs, he's hitting it hard and, you know, elevating it a little bit, and he just looks really comfortable in the box. And most of the time in the past, there hadn't been an obvious correlation, you know, with something that you could see with your eyes as, oh, that's what he's doing, and that's why he's looking much better. And this time around, there was the toe tap. So I think there was something tangible that we can and maybe still could even in the future latch onto and say, okay, this is what he's doing, and now he looks, because of this, it looks like he's back to, you know, a very good hitter, you know, the good form of Christian Yelich. Whereas in the past, you know, it's like, okay, he looks better. Don't really know what exactly is different. So, you know, who knows how long it'll last. Whereas, you know, I guess you kind of hoped that, that with, you know, the toe tap and the mechanical adjustments, like it's a more lasting impact. And it seems after this, you know, during this over 23 skid, that it's kind of just the same thing as it was in the past, you know, a couple good weeks here, a couple rough weeks there. And that's where we're at. We're back to the same square, kind of, except this square, like you said, is devoid of, you know, home run power. And that's the Brewers as a lineup aren't missing home run power, but they are missing Christian Yelich's home run power badly. I mean, it just, there's just countless spots where you think, oh my gosh, they could, like, if you know, they could just use a Christian Yelich homer here so badly. And instead it just isn't happening.
Yeah, especially because he's getting, you know, at the top of the order, he's getting more at bats than everybody else, which is good. Like, there are still points where I think he's the best hitter on the team, and then, you know, comes up in a big spot and you just need that pop, and it just it doesn't show. So yeah, I agree with you there. He's got, I believe, the same OPS as he did last year, or at least if it's not identical, it's very close to identical. Better OPS plus because the overall environment isn't as good as it was last year. So he's still a little bit better, I guess, overall than last year. But it's starting to look kind of like a copy of 2021 as we get deeper into the season. Okay, so Keston Hira, if there's one thing I hear about most from people on Twitter, it's the usage of Keston Hira. Like, and I think, you know, we have talked about this a little bit. Like, he's still one of their most productive offensive players, but he barely plays. And in fact, in games where you get, everyone seems to know, I think at this point, that he hits right-handers very well, left-handers poorly. No one knows why. He's a right-handed batter, but that's just the way it's gone. So all the same, when a left-hander is on the mound, the Brewers let him bat in those lineups because Rowdy Tellez, who is their preferred first baseman, he does not hit left-handers as well. So they give Rowdy a rest on those days, let Keston play. But the second a right-hander comes in, Keston has been pulled from the lineup. That happened twice this week. You know, Hira hit the game-tying home run against the Reds on last Sunday, in a game that the Brewers ultimately didn't win. So he had kind of another triumphant, nice moment. And then he was pulled from the middle of games, both against Tampa Bay, in that first series at American Family Field. You heard barking both times. Now, the second time, Rowdy Tellez was the star of the show. He ends up hitting the game-tying home run, making a huge play. Like, it ends up looking really good that they made that transition. But the overall point that people have is, here's a guy who can hit right-handers. When you have a right-hander coming in, why are you in a hurry to put Rowdy Tellez in that spot? I know the Brewers prefer him over Keston Hira, but Keston's numbers against righties are still very good, you know? And isn't it worth giving him a chance to sort of spread his wings offensively? So what would you say to people who are just still baffled as to how this team uses Keston Hira and how little they seem to trust him?
Jay, you're talking to the guy who all year has been confused by this.
You love Keston Hira, man.
I just like, you look throughout the organization, it's like you've developed one guy, you know, like in the last decade.
Yeah.
Who's been your legit hitting prospect? It's been Hira. And I think there's some glaring deficiencies, and I think his stats are a bit propped up by like a high batting average on balls in play, and like guys who strike out this much, it's really hard for them to sustain success, and that's probably what like the underlying thing the Brewers are looking at is. But I at a point, like, he's just, every time he's been in there, he's produced throughout the year. You send him down, you call him back up, he produces. You do it again, he produces again. So you just, like, you miss his bat on days like Sunday, where you get two early runs and then Miles Michaelis strikes out, or not strikes out, but retires like 19 of 21 or something. I don't necessarily think it needs to even be a Hira versus Tellez, like, you know, comparison.
Yeah, binary, right.
Yeah, but because as we've talked about, it feels like ad nauseum this year, the issue is he's a weird fit on the roster because he doesn't have a defensive home.
Right. Well, that's why it's binary.
Should be first base. Yeah.
That's why it's binary.
Should be first base, but he can't hit lefties. And Tellez mashes righties, so it creates for the difficult spot. But there are ways to get in the lineup. You can DH him against righties. I don't think Andrew McCutchen looked that bad in center field. If you're that devoted to playing Andrew McCutchen, but I honestly don't know if you need to be as devoted to playing a league average hitter who's been better over the last, 2.5 months, but there's still not a lot of power there. And I mean, here has been a better hitter this year than McCutchen has. So I think there's more spots to play him that they aren't just really, looking for, taking advantage of. The commitment though is to playing McCutchen every day and hitting him cleanup, despite him being a league average hitter. It's the decision at this point. I would not expect things to change, but I don't know. It's just a bit puzzling, even though I understand like the rationale behind, you don't expect a guy that strikes out that much to be that good over time.
Yeah, I got my game screwed up, by the way. That wasn't the first Tampa game that he had been taken out here. It was that Saturday game against the Reds before he had the big moment on Sunday where he had homered actually in that game against the lefty. And then was replaced by Rowdy Tellez. But yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is because he can't play second base, or at least the Brewers aren't comfortable with him there. Outfield is still an experiment at best. He's a first baseman unless he's the DH, and first baseman, it's Tellez versus Kira, and the Brewers, for better or worse, if you're a Brewers fan, I understand this may not be the type of thing you believe in, but the Brewers trust Rowdy Tellez in that spot more than Keston Hira, and they will default to Rowdy Tellez whenever possible. That's just kind of my read on it, and it doesn't matter the situation. I also think, too, so we've been trained, I think, as baseball people to just think how valuable the right versus left split is, and it is a little more complicated than that. Some pitchers are lefties who get lefties out, or righties out, because they have the right pitch or something like that. It's never as simple as he's a right-hander or a left-hander. Each pitcher is a different story, so that also has to be factored in a little bit.
I'll say I think Hira's best position might actually be left field.
I think maybe
there's an obvious issue with that, though.
There certainly is. Pursuant to our previous conversation with Christian Yelich, kind of entrenched there for the next several years. All right, let's move into the more granular details from the week. Let's go 2-3 up, 3 down. Easy as 1, 2, 3. Do you want to kick it off this week, Kurt? Otherwise, I could.
Can I kick it?
You can kick it. Go for it.
Yes, I can. Okay. You are not quite picking up what I've been down there. That's okay. That's okay. I'll begin with Tyrone Taylor.
Of course,
alluded to his defensive play in general earlier in the podcast. But then on Tuesday, I believe it was, he scales the wall somewhat a la Lorenzo Cain, not quite low Cainian, but robs David Peralta of a homer. I think it was that the first Brewers robbed homer of the season.
I cannot think of another one. Yeah.
Can't think of it. I think Yelich has had maybe a nice play back there, but I don't think there's been another one. It was a true robbed homer. That spot in right center is a great spot to take dingers away at American Family Field. Great play, great reaction from Freddie Peralta as well as David Peralta. So it was sort of the defensive highlight of the week.
Yeah, David Peralta had a really good series. Another trade deadline acquisition who's done very well for their team. Oh. Jealousy. Okay, so there's two games. I don't know which one I'll start. Let me just go Saturday. I feel like you could write a pretty lengthy sort of, dissertation on either the game Wednesday or Saturday. I think they're both at this point among the five greatest wins the Brewers have had this season. Saturday, no at-bats with runners in scoring position. None throughout the course of the game until extra innings. And the only reason it started that way is because you start with a runner at second base in the 10th inning. That was their first at-bat with runners in scoring position. Adam Wainwright, of course, throwing a no-hitter until two outs in the 7th. Luis Arias with a clutch 8th inning home run opposite field. And then in the 10th, you get the big hits. Hunter Renfro, the RBI triple from the big man. He gives the Brewers the lead. And then Colton Wong with the sacrifice fly. That ultimately is the winning run. 3-2, the Brewers win. Just an incredible, I don't want to call it lucky because they had to have the pitching to get them to that point, and they had to, they did have to come through with those hits, but there's no scenario where I envision the Brewers winning that game the way it was going, the way Adam Wainwright was dealing. Corbin Burns was certainly matching him, but, the expectations were pretty low there that the Brewers offense would find enough to pull that off, and yet they did. Also, tremendous troll job by the St. Louis Cardinals, honoring their 1982 Championship World Series team 1 week after the Brewers did the same at their place. Yes. Of course, the Cardinals.
Yes.
Won that World Series, so just a little salt in the wound there for the Cardinals. But the Brewers do win that night, one of the craziest games of the year. And honestly, like I said, is it hyperbole to say that win might have saved their season? Because going into this week, a game and a half out of first versus 3.5 games out feels like just a monumental mountain of difference. And this is not a game that I think they normally would win. This was a theft. So that game I'm going to come back to quite a bit, depending on how this goes from here. I feel like that's a pretty important signpost in this season.
Yeah, no, I don't think you're overreacting to say, I mean, okay, maybe a little of an overreaction to say it's a must win in August, but
yeah,
things considered, they absolutely needed that game. And I'm going to stay on night with my second 3-up, 3-down here. Hunter Renfro's triple, the triple to right, kind of right center at Coors Field on a slightly misplayed ball. Is on a very unlikely guy to get a triple, reminds in a key spot in the game. Can you think of another time in, say, the last 4 or so years where that situation happened? Testing your memory here. Is there a play that reminded you of, jogged your memory?
No, but I will say this, that the triple's going to come up and remember when, so put a pin in that. But anyway, you tell me what I should be remembering.
Okay, I will put a pin in that. Eric Thames.
Oh.
Down the stretch, it was the final week of 2018. I believe the game was tied, eighth inning, maybe ninth inning. I can't remember if it was the first. I think it might have been the first game of that series. I think the Brewers entered a game or two up on the wild card. Very intense games, and Eric Thames hits a go-ahead RBI triple to right field. I think there was a dive, and the ball was missed, and it was just a generally very fluky play that benefited the Brewers, and then watching Hunter Renfro slice it over the right fielder's head and dash its way around to third base reminded me of that. So there's that.
Very good. Yes. All right, let's go to the Tuesday game, because the defense in that series against Tampa Bay, we've talked about how we feel the defense maybe isn't like below average per se, but definitely seems to have come up with some bad plays in key moments over the course of the year. And I thought that defense in that Tampa Bay series was exemplary, especially in that Wednesday game. Tyrone Taylor, who stole the home run, like you mentioned, on Tuesday night, he made two great defensive plays on Wednesday, including a diving catch. Rowdy Tellez, with the presence of mind to go across the diamond first to third in extra innings to erase the automatic runner at second base. That was a very ballsy call. It's not something I would have done. I remember saying it out loud in the moment, like, oh no, don't go to third. But that's exactly what he did. He was out by plenty. Francisco Mejia was the runner there. So brilliant play there. Then Victor Caratini throws the runner out. You had Keston Hira laying out to pick up a throw at first base. He had a couple great plays. And then the biggest moment that I don't even know if it made my game story. It mentioned at the end, but Hobie Milner, two huge strikeouts against two guys in the middle of their lineup. But when he inherited a mess, bases loaded when Brad Boxberger was taken out of the game, Hobie Milner with a huge escape that allows the Brewers to end up tying and subsequently winning that game. So a lot of things went right for them on Wednesday. Just a great all-around game. One of their better games, I think, that they've played in recent memory.
Oh, absolutely. I'll cap off my list here. Adam Wainwright's performance. I thought he was going to throw a no-hitter.
He did too. He talked about how he thought it was coming.
Yeah. Early on, I think it was like the third inning. I messaged you. I was like, Maddux incoming? This is going to be a Maddux, isn't it?
Yep.
And then it actually played out, and it was going to be if Luis Urias doesn't ambush an early fastball in the eighth inning. I mean, it was vintage Wainwright, and the Brewers were completely baffled by his curveball.
Yeah, we were trying to come up with a name for something that was both a Maddux and a no-hitter. We're going with Nomax, or at least that's what I was going with, a Nomax. I don't think that quite flies. I don't think it works. But it was a perfect performance, pretty much, and the Brewers are able to just do enough to interrupt it. Credit to Urias, credit to Andrew McCutchen to get to, you know, sort of like break the spell a little bit. Just too massive. That win is just massive. It's recency bias, and I can't separate from that yet. So I don't know if I'll be like talking about that win at the end of the year necessarily, but it feels just huge in the moment. Let me close it down with Jackson Chourio, 4-for-4 on Sunday to cap off yet another good week with the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers. Earlier this week, he went to number 2 overall in the Baseball America prospect rankings. I don't even know if we said Jackson Chourio's name before this season, but right now he's the greatest prospect the Brewers have ever had. If you believe, you know, if you go by the Baseball America list, which obviously that's an overstatement, but the Brewers have never had anybody ranked that highly in the minor leagues. Again, still 18 years old, still a long way away from 19, and absolutely mashing the ball. He's got 4 homers now. He had a homer again on Sunday at Advanced Single A Wisconsin. And it is a fun journey watching this guy because he's just not slowing down. And, you know, I know you've covered him and you've seen him and we've talked about him. We probably don't need to say much more, but the dreaming continues as Jackson Chourio rises to the level of one of the biggest, if not maybe the best prospect in Major League Baseball.
JR, I have a regret I want to share with you.
Tell me about your regret.
So you mentioned, how much have we talked about Jackson Chourio coming into this year? Well, let me tell you. I'm in a fairly deep deep National League only dynasty fantasy baseball league. Very very, okay. Very nerdy thing. And each year we have a draft where we can select players that were either international signees or taken in the MLB draft. And by the time my final pick of the draft rolls around, I message someone and I go, you know, I'm thinking about this Jackson Chourio guy. I think there might be something there. Mm-hmm. And I come very close to drafting him. I do not do that. I instead take Alex Benelis.
Oh yeah.
Because okay. I covered the kid at Oak Creek High School. And as did you. As
yes.
did you. And he was, you know, he was mashing. He absolutely mashed in his, you know, pro season or his pro ball debut with the Brewers. So I took Benelis and I said, Chourio's 17. He's so far away. I'll have time if he kind of flashes a little bit next year.
Oh.
And then he flashed. And then I went to pick him up. And one of my league mates at Brewers Farm, shout out Nolan Bratt, got him the day before. And I was burned, and I have deep, deep, deep sorrow and regret over that series of decisions.
Yeah, that's a big fail on your part. But maybe are you in an NFC only? You could get Romeo Dobbs, the Packers.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely what I'm doing for the start of an NFC only. I will not let him slide. Romeo Dobbs is the chief, by the way.
Yeah, very excited about his progress as well. Although he fumbled after catching a touchdown in that first preseason game, so we have to mitigate expectations all the way around with Chourio too. Like, I know that there will be a heavy adjustment when he gets to Double A. It's just it's kind of crazy watching him just continue to impress. So there it is, 3 up, 3 down. Now let's go back in time. It's Remember When. All right, you mentioned the triple, Hunter Renfro, first triple in a few years. But that's actually, and that's related to this, but really why I was thinking about this is because Mario Feliciano, the Brewers now backup catcher with Omar Narvaez, still hurt, still out another week, presumably because he's still several days away from a rehab start. So it's been Victor Caratini catching every day. And then on Sunday, Mario Feliciano finally got in the game. Feliciano's only Major League at-bat came in May, early May of 2021, last year. And he walked, he reached. And so I just happened to look up who are the guys in Brewers history that have reached or gotten a hit in their only at bat with the Brewers. And of course there are a lot of pitchers on that list. K-Rod, by the way, is one of them. He has a hit in his only at bat, but it jogged my memory about another guy who has a triple in his only Brewers at bat. It is only Major League at bat because he's also a pitcher. His name is Eduardo Rodriguez, and we're going back here to 1973. So Eduardo Rodriguez, this is 1973, by the way, is the first year where the designated hitter exists in the American League. So prior to that, and people may not remember that, the Brewers, American League and all, for those first couple seasons, the pitchers batted. The DH didn't exist yet. But by 73, it's gone. So this is a game in September. September 3rd, 1973, against Cleveland. And when he came into the game, top of the eighth, he actually gave up an RBI single, but it was a huge blowout. Cleveland, you know, Cleveland had been, or the Brewers had been up on Cleveland like 10-1. I think by the end of that inning, it was 10-4. And then the batter in front of his spot in the order hit a 2-run homer to make it 12-5 when the Brewers came to bat in the bottom of the eighth. And he's a 21-year-old kid at the time. The designated hitter had gone in to play left field. So that had erased the designated hitter out of the lineup. So he was in the batting order. No American League pitcher had batted that year. This is September. It was the first and only at-bat for an American League pitcher this year. This 21-year-old kid who did not believe that he was actually being sent to the plate. He questioned manager Del Crandall. He's like, what's that? Pitchers don't bat. So what's going on? He gets up there and he hits a ball to the gap, and it's a triple. He ran through a stop sign. His third base coach told him to stop at second base. He did not do that, and wound up coming all the way to third base. And then the throw got away, so he scores. It's a Little League home run. The relay came in wild. Just a crazy thing. It was the first game of a doubleheader. Cleveland actually won the nightcap and turned a triple play in that game. So there was a lot going on. This is 1973. The Brewers are not a good team. So late in the season, there's not a lot to talk about. But this was an interesting day. So a triple, his only major league at bat. He was the only American League pitcher to bat that year. And Eduardo Rodriguez, a fascinating little nugget. The Brewers actually had a pitcher who got a hit in 74 as well. Tom Murphy, one of two pitchers who got a hit in 1974. And after that, the next American League pitcher to get a hit all the way in 1991. There's a couple in 96 as well. Then interleague play enters the fray. So you get a couple, you get a few every year at that point. But just a weird moment and an RBI trip, not an RBI triple, but ultimately a run scores on this random triple. All right, that's all I got for there. What about let's close it down, Kurt. What do you have for your take of the week? It's Kurt Blanche, everyone.
Ryan Braun sends it for off center and deep. Get out of here, gone for Ryan Braun. He just hit a walk off homer.
My Kurt Blanche of the week is not about Carlos Corporan, but I'm glad that you talked about one at bats of the Brewers and base hits, because Carlos Corporan is the name that comes to my mind.
Trevor Richards. Trevor Richards got on base in his only Brewers at bat plate appearance.
Josh Hader, maybe.
No, Josh Hader does have a hit.
He has multiple
at-bats.
Dan Jennings might be one of them.
He is not. No Dan Jennings on my list. I'm sorry.
Dan Jennings? Oh, he must have had multiple at-bats. Okay, anyway, my carte blanche. Well, carte blanche. No, it's Kurt Blanche, kids.
You got to have the pun.
I'm going to start this sentence, and I don't know where I'm going with it.
Okay, let's ride.
The Brewers were absolutely right to do very minimal at the trade deadline.
And also, it made
no sense for them to do nothing at the trade deadline. Hear me out. I understand the bites of the apple argument, and as much as fans don't want to hear it at this point, and I think it does, maybe give across some vibes of like we only care about like doing the bare minimum to make the playoffs, and then hopefully we get hot. But that's neither here nor there. I do think it's generally a wise baseball strategy. Get in the playoffs. Build a team that will get you to the playoffs, and then let the rest figure out. I just don't know whether the top of their current farm system was worth mortgaging for this current iteration of the Brewers. Now, they could prove me wrong and get hot, and maybe they are just missing a piece or two. But unless you are going to get, Josh Bell or a real impact starter, I don't know. I don't think, trading, obviously Churio's not in the equation, but, it's tough too, cause we don't know what the ask prices were, but trading away Garrett Mitchell or any of those other AAA outfielders like Sal Frelick that we talked about, or, some of the legitimate group of current position players that's as good as they've had since the Weeks fielder era. That's how good this current crop of prospects is. And so was adding to this team worth losing any of those guys? I don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. And I don't know how much of that was the calculus. Is like, we can't, we legitimately think we have a real shot, like a real shot with these guys in 3-4 years. But I don't know. It's just been 2.5 months of kind of uninspiring baseball, and who knows, they could get hot and turn that around. But I just don't know how much in addition would have flipped the season. Now, I also don't think that's necessarily like a super valid excuse for them not adding. I wrote that they needed to add a bat somewhere. But the reality of the matter is the group they have has not played well enough in the last week and a half, 2 weeks. And that's the biggest reason for their struggles. And they probably would have been struggling one way or the other. Yeah. I did not know where I was going with that thought. And I don't know if I contradicted myself like three times in there or not, but just my lingering thoughts on the current state of the Brewers.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, that it really the Atlanta Braves were arguably the worst of the National League teams to make the playoffs last year, and they won the World Series. In 2019, the Washington Nationals, we know them well, like, that team got lucky. The Brewers should have beaten them in the wild card game, and then they just get on a magic carpet ride and win it all the way to the World Series. Now, those are just two examples. You know, there's also, you could easily say, although, you know, ironically, in 2020, the weirdest year ever, the Dodgers, the best team, ended up winning the whole thing. Like, the Dodgers don't have that many championships. You know, they keep taking bites at the apple, and it's not getting them anywhere. So the point is, it just gets really, really random when you get down to the nitty gritty. If you are in the race and if you are in the playoffs, it gets really random. So, and look at some of the guys that they've added, bats that they've added. You know, Eduardo Escobar last year, it didn't really make a difference. He was perfect for them. He was exactly what they needed. And he moved the needle not very much. Jonathan Scope, everyone remembers as a guy who didn't work out. Mike Moustakas had a great hit in the postseason. But, you know, his value ultimately was him coming back for 2019. He had a pretty good season in 2019. 2018, he was okay. Like, he didn't change that team into a playoff team overnight. He maybe helped a little bit in a situation where one game made all the difference. That might have been the move you had to make. So you know, like, I think we maybe romanticize just how much a bat can do, because we do know of a couple examples off the top of our head, you know, the Yoenis Cespedeses of the world, where they really just sort of help a team transform. There aren't many situations like that. I will say, though, it feels like there is enough of a crisis on offense that they probably could have tried someone.
I think that's part of what I'm getting into, is like, there's value in trying.
Yes. Which, of course, I'm sure they tried. I'm sure they tried.
And it's hard for me to, and maybe I'm just too high on like Tristan Peters and Anton Kelly, but it's hard for me to kind of like marry the idea of, okay, being willing to pay those prices for, especially like Rosenthal, hopefully a month of a guy who hasn't pitched in 2 years for Tristan Peters, and then not being willing to pay any price for the bats. But the reality of the matter is, like, if they were going or are going to win a World Series or get to a World Series or win a playoff series or at this point even make the playoffs, it was going to be driven by the current group that was in the clubhouse. We also thought that current group included Josh Hader. That's another thing that's neither here nor there. It's like that they need who they have, the roster that they've constructed, to play better. Now, that does not absolve how the roster was constructed and some of the flaws, or like I said, not adding anything and like, you know, hoping you kind of get hot with like Brandon Drury or something, or, you know, maybe paying a little something for Trey Mancini or whatever it was. But I guess at the heart of what I'm saying is this, the players that are on the Brewers and, you know, were there before the trade deadline and are there now, they've just needed to play better, and they simply have not.
It's hard to know, because it involves some bullpen blowups. If the calculus would have been different, if they have a couple more wins with Hader. But I would also argue that some of the wins they got this week, these past few days, were pretty fortuitous, and you kind of have to be happy with what you got. The Pirates series is having leads in all three of those games. It stings a little bit. They had another lead on Sunday, a 2-run lead that didn't stick. But they haven't won a game they've won one game by more than 2 runs in the month of August in 2 weeks. You know, that's not on your closer, right? Like, that's not the only issue. It might be an issue, but it's not the only one. That's a problem. So the Brewers are now tasked with trying to bounce back against the best team in the National League. No big deal. 4 games, the Dodgers come to town, and then it's the Cubs. So a chance to relax a little bit before going to LA to face the Dodgers there. This is a very tenuous spot for them. The Brewers just have to, you know, tread water a little bit more here and hopefully get a chance in that final month of the season, that favorable final month of the season to make a move. Kurt, appreciate it, man. Any last thoughts before I let you go?
No, I think we rambled and incoherently enough over the last 45 minutes. So I'll leave the listeners there.
Thanks for tuning in to Microbrew this week. We will be back next week. We'll have another special interview next week, tacked onto that episode as well. And we will catch you again soon. Thanks for joining us, everybody. Bye-bye.